the Farm Bill. It's legislation worth more than $90 billion for everything from farm subsidies to crop insurance. But over 80% of this massive outlay goes to the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP, what we used to call food stamps. More than 45 million people depend on SNAP, especially since the economic downturn. But in the current versions of the bill, Democrats are talking about cutting some of those funds, and Republicans talk about cutting even more. I'm Brian Ellison. This hour, we bring you a special joint broadcast of Central Standard by Iowa Public Radio and KCUR Kansas City. Tomorrow, Talk of Iowa will look at crop insurance and subsidies, but today we'll be exploring the future of America's largest hunger safety net. That's on Central Standard after the news. The Senate passed it last week, the House starts up the debate today, and the White House is threatening a veto. Few pieces of legislation can produce such sharp divisions, even by Washington standards, but few could have such immediate, significant impact on so many Americans. From KCUR in Kansas City, this is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and today the first of two special joint broadcasts about the Farm Bill. From Iowa Public Radio and Kansas City Public Media. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, Charity Nebbe will guide us all in a live conversation about the impact of the bill's proposals on agriculture and farming. But today, we're focusing on the part of the bill that you may not even know exists from our term for it, the Farm Bill. But in fact, it makes up the vast majority of the bill's expenditure, something like $78 billion, and directly affects the wallets of about 47 million Americans. Joining us to talk about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, is Amy Mayer. She's a reporter for Iowa Public Radio, and she joins us this morning from Ames. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing from Congressman. We're working to crack the audio with Amy there. We'll be hearing in a few minutes from Congressman Emanuel Cleaver and a policy scholar who have concerns in the House about the bill that's passing for very different reasons. But first, let's talk to Amy Mayer, where we're getting some kind of a feedback loop. Looks like she may need to turn off her microphone and go with the phone connection. Amy, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay. Looks like we're good. Thank you so much for
Sorry
being
about
with
that.
Us. No problem. Amy, let's take a step back. What is the Farm Bill?
Well, the Farm Bill is this massive piece of legislation, as you mentioned. The overall expenditure, including SNAP, comes to almost $1 trillion over 10 years. It covers all of the major agricultural policies, such as crop insurance subsidies, conservation on farmland, and, of course, the nutrition programs you talked about. Those are really the big hitters. There are a lot of smaller programs as well that have to do with beginning in new farmers and ranchers, school nutrition. Well, actually, that's sort of a big one. And also some of the local food initiatives. And there's also a lot of research.
And these different pieces, they aren't all equally important in terms of the money involved. Obviously, we'll be talking today about SNAP. What are the other most significant parts of the bill?
Besides SNAP, I would say for farmers, probably at this point the most important thing, especially here in the Midwest, is crop insurance and crop insurance subsidies. That's really now going to be the number one safety net for farmers. Linked with that is the conservation aspect of the Farm Bill, that there are several different programs funded in the Farm Bill that help farmers to prevent erosion, diminish nutrient runoff, and take other measures on their land, typically less productive cropland, that will, the thinking goes, overall help to improve both their land and the overall environment, such as water quality and some of the other factors that affect all of us, wildlife habitat and so forth.
So I guess I'm curious, Amy, why are all these things lumped together in one piece of legislation called the Farm Bill?
Right. Well, the Farm Bill, of course, is a shorthand, and every year that there's a new one, they have a different name for it that involves energy sometimes, jobs, and so forth, agricultural reform. But they date back initially to 1933 was the first piece of legislation that sort of eventually became known as the Farm Bill. And the reason so many different aspects came together is twofold. To begin with, when Franklin Roosevelt started his first program to help struggling farmers during the Great Depression, hunger relief was a really important aspect of that effort. And then, of course, programs to help them prevent the sort of dust bowl blowing off of the soil that had been so problematic then. That was the origin of the conservation title. But nowadays, and probably since about, at least the 80s, maybe before that, the nutrition programs, and in particular what used to be called food stamps and is now Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, were folded into the Farm Bill even as they grew bigger and started to outpace the Farm Bill in dollar amounts, because the lawmakers from the rural farm communities needed the collaboration of their urban counterparts in the House, especially, and also in the Senate, in order to get a bill that would support agriculture passed. So it's really, I like the way one person I spoke with put it, politically, historically convenient.
Right. Now, has it always been so divisive as it has been this year? Is this just historically always a source of conflict, or has it generally gone more smoothly than this?
I think that this urban-rural split has always had its detractors or has always generated a certain amount of controversy. Last year, which was supposed to be the reauthorization of the 2008 Farm Bill, with it being a presidential election, was especially controversial. It was, I think, the difference between House Republicans and House Democrats was just vast, and a bridge that people running for re-election and supporting their various candidates didn't want to, those were waters they didn't want to wade into particularly. It seemed less dangerous politically to not vote on the Farm Bill in the House than to force members to vote on it and then be held accountable for those votes. That's sort of my understanding of the thinking last year. So in a sense, this year, it's a tiny bit less controversial than it was last year, but I think still a much more contentious debate than there had been perhaps 5 years ago or in the bill previous. At least it certainly feels that way. And as you mentioned, SNAP is so huge now, and a lot of the rub is about how much SNAP will be cut.
And so last year, when the House and Senate weren't able to agree on a final version of the bill, it was just extended for a year, the same expenditures from 2008. So there's a deadline coming up on September 30th. What happens if nothing gets passed this time?
That's a really good question. I mean, leading up to it not passing last year, there was a lot of discussion about what would happen to certain programs that might cease to exist. There was a lot of discussion over dairy, because the way that dairy supports are structured, there was a threat that we were going to revert to a payment scheme that was applied first in 1949 and would have just been anachronistic. I think I'm hearing less rhetoric at this stage about what happens if, which suggests to me that there's a little more optimism that it will get passed. If it doesn't, it's hard to see, if they didn't pass a new 5-year farm bill, it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't come up with some other short-term fix, because the amount of money and the amount of people's livelihoods and the amount of food support that rides on this is so vast that it's hard for me to imagine that they could not pass a farm bill and not do something else for the interim and just have it all go away on October 1st.
But, so we're talking today mostly about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. How much of the bill is represented by that portion?
Well, the way the Senate bill is written is, the way the 2008 Farm Bill was appropriated, 67% of the total was allocated to domestic nutrition programs. There's some variability, obviously, year to year. The number of eligible participants changes, and the amount that a person uses those benefits could change. But in 2010, for example, about 80% of the Farm Bill spending was specifically on nutrition assistance. And that 80% is often quoted as, you know, here we call this the Farm Bill, but it's actually 80% supplemental nutrition and other nutrition programs.
And how many people are we talking about? How many people are receiving benefits through the SNAP program?
Right now, the most recent figure I saw was that 47 million Americans are using SNAP benefits, which is about 1 in 7.
Yeah, and who are these folks? I mean, what income level does one have to be below in order to receive these benefits?
The eligibility requirements are another thing that is coming under review. The House proposal is a little bit different from the Senate version. Both of them do make some changes from what the current requirements are. I don't have right in front of me exactly what the maximum income level is, but I do know that one of the considerations is possibly reducing the amount of assets that an applicant could have. So, for example, somebody who's lost their job and doesn't have a lot of savings would perhaps want to apply for SNAP. There's going to be some discussion about whether if that person owns a house, would that make their eligibility different? Would they need to sell something like a car in order to be eligible? So those are some of the wrinkles that are still being debated.
We'll be talking in the second half of our show today with some recipients of these benefits, former recipients, as well as some local charities who support people who receive them. I'm talking with Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio about the Farm Bill. Amy, you've mentioned the Senate bill and the House bill. The Senate passed a bill last week, 66-27. It wasn't totally along party lines. It was sort of an interesting mix of support. In Missouri, Senator McCaskill, Senator Blunt. In Kansas, Senator Moran. In Iowa, Senator Grassley and Tom Harkin all supported it. Only Senator Roberts among our three states voted against it. What were the differences between that bill and the one that's now under consideration in the House?
The most significant dollar difference between the two bills is how much they would cut the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The bill that was passed in the Senate last week would cut SNAP by $400 million a year, whereas the proposal that's on the floor of the House right now would cut it by $2 billion a year. So that's a pretty wide...
Five times as much.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, there are a few other differences. For example, the bill that passed the Senate calls for cross-compliance for conservation, which means people who would like to participate in the crop insurance subsidy program will be required to also show that they are participating in certain conservation programs. Cross-compliance isn't new. That has been required with other farm bill programs in the past, but this would be the first time it's tied to crop insurance subsidies. The House bill at the moment doesn't contain a cross-compliance requirement.
You know, to bring this full circle, the money that is spent on SNAP isn't completely irrelevant for farmers, is it?
I very much agree with what you just said. For one thing, increasingly, SNAP benefits can be used in farmers markets and certain other local providers. So farmers markets obviously are a place where generally smaller farmers, often newer farmers, are participating, and that's money that's going to go directly to them. But in addition, you know, even though we have this sort of dichotomous conversation about the farm bill, farming is about producing food. SNAP is about providing food to the hungry. So even when someone spends their SNAP benefits at a traditional grocery store, you have to see that some amount of that, even if it's a small amount, does eventually make its way back to the farmer who produced the food that ends up on the store shelves.
That's Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio. She's joined us by phone from Ames, Iowa. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk with one local member of Congress who will be casting a vote on the House version of the Farm Bill, as well as a conservative scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. He'll join us, too, so stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to a special joint broadcast of Central Standard on Iowa Public Radio and KCUR Kansas City Public Media.
This is KCUR Kansas City. Good morning.
Punk and grunge and then hip-hop, MTV helped define the generations. But millennials, boy, they're different.
And so when we ask the question, what are you rebelling against? You got blank stares.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the guy who runs MTV and the millennial mindset as a business proposition next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us for Marketplace at 6:30 on KCUR. And today on Fresh Air, we hear from people behind the comic trio The Lonely Island, who began making musical parodies on SNL. They have a new album with guest appearances by Lady Gaga and Justin Timberlake. Fresh Air, today at 3 on KCUR. Funding for KCUR is made possible in part by KC Teach, a union of the UMKC Schools of Education and Biological Sciences and the College of Arts and Sciences, producing more high school science and math teachers. Details are online at education.umkc.edu/kc-teach. The time is 10:21. It's 82 degrees in Midtown Kansas City. You're listening to KCUR and KCUR.org, a service of the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
From KCUR in Kansas City, this is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, the first of a two-part special program on the Farm Bill in a joint broadcast with Iowa Public Radio. Joining us to talk about the policy and political implications of this week's Farm Bill debate in the U.S. House of Representatives are Congressman Emanuel Cleaver II, a Democrat from here in Kansas City, who joins us by phone from Washington. Congressman Cleaver, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And Vincent Smith. He's a professor in the Agricultural Economics Department at Montana State University, also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us by phone from Montana State. Good morning, Vincent Smith.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Very nice to have you. We want to note that we invited several Republican members of Congress to be with us today. Congressman Kevin Yoder, Tim Huelskamp, Mike Pompeo from Kansas, Lynn Jenkins and Vicky Hartzler from Missouri, Tom Latham and Steve King from Iowa. They all were occupied today and weren't able to join us, but we did want to include their voice. Let me start with you, Congressman Cleaver. The House Agriculture Committee passed its version of the Farm Bill 36-10 last month. It was not a party line vote. I know that both of you probably agree there's a need to pass a Farm Bill. Congressman Cleaver, is this the one? How would you vote on the bill as it stands now?
Well, as it stands right now, I would be leaning no, but we have probably over 100 amendments that will very likely come up over the next 48 hours. I do need to also say that that vote, 36-10, was, you know, what Washington called bipartisan. I'm not sure that the world calls it that, because I think there were only one or two Democrats who voted to move the bill to the floor. There is still a great division here in Washington between the House version and the Senate version.
And why do Democrats so strongly oppose the bill as it stands now out of committee?
Well, for a couple of reasons. The first, which I think most people can predict, is the members of the House were appalled at a proposed $20 billion cut in the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, used to be called food stamps, and they thought that was a bit much. And I think there was also some opposition to the bill based on the dairy component of the bill, which has a new insurance program. I don't want to get too deeply in the woods on the dairy program, but it would do away with price supports and allow farmers to then purchase a new kind of insurance that pays out when the price they receive for milk and the price and the feed cost narrows. But I think that the Colin Peterson had been a very big proponent of trying to create a solution to the problem through what he considered a stabilization program, which would be voluntary. But farmers who participate, we have to sign up for this stabilization program that could, in fact, dictate production costs when an oversupply drives down the price.
Right.
And the speaker called it, I think, socialism or communism. I can't remember which one.
Right. So, Colin Peterson's the ranking Democrat on the House Agriculture Committee.
Yes, I'm sorry. And Speaker Boehner opposes that part of the bill.
Vincent Smith, you're a visiting scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. It's been reported that leaders of that organization are among those opposing the Farm Bill, sort of from the other side of the political spectrum from Congressman Cleaver. Why is that, and do you agree? Is this a good bill?
Well, just a quick note. I actually am a middle-of-the-road Democrat. Nobody likes this bill except for the farm sector, who stand to do very well out of the bill. And so Missouri farmers and Iowa farmers are very supportive of the bill. Farmers are about 1% of the population. The other 99% are going to be faced with potentially very large taxpayer obligations under the House, particularly the House, but also the Senate version of the Farm Bill. But to speak to Congressman Cleaver's concerns about nutrition programs, The problem for the House Agricultural Committee, and this really is both Frank Lucas, who owns his own farm, and Congressman Peterson, is that, this bill actually has potential to substantially increase payments to farms that are mainly very large and who farm families that are very wealthy. 80% of the money is going to go to the 15% of the largest farms. The net worth of those guys is in the multiple million dollars. And at the same time, there's a proposal to significantly cut back spending on the food stamp program, as Congressman Cleaver has very accurately pointed out. The other problem with this bill is that through the dairy program, for the first time in donkey's years, to be truthful, Congressman Peterson has come up with supply controls that would disadvantage the most dynamic part of the dairy industry. His goal seems to be to ensure that every farm survives, even if it has 10 cows and a plow. It's one of the most poorly designed ways of giving farmers money that Congress has come up with in 50 years. With apologies to Congressman Cleaver, Congress, the House Committee and Senate Committees on Agriculture would be very creative and from an economic perspective, very wasteful in many of the programs they've developed. So there's this real ethical dilemma built into the House proposal that is Congressman Frank Lucas and the supporters of the bill want to effectively, though the scoring doesn't quite reflect this, increase spending and payments to largely very wealthy people while cutting off support to very, very poor people.
All right, thank you.
It's not a good bill.
Dr. Smith, I want to give Congressman Cleaver a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, I don't disagree very much with Professor Smith on that. In fact, I do think that the farm bill, like so many other pieces of legislation in Washington, does lean toward the wealthy. There's no question about that. But, I mean, I would challenge anybody on the other side or on my side to challenge that. They can't. It's axiomatic. It's a fact.
Well,
and that's what makes it even more objectionable when you're talking about cutting programs that would aid the poor when you're leaning already so far toward the rich.
Well, let's talk about those programs that are designed to aid the poor. I should mention, by the way, Professor Smith mentioned Frank Lucas. He's the chair of the House Agriculture Committee. We invited him to be part of today's program as well, but and probably understandably was it's a busy day for him, but he was unable to join us. The program at the center of a lot of these conversations, 80% of the bill, is the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Both the House and the Senate versions of this bill talk about cutting it, but the House bill that's on the floor now would cut it far more, five times as much, in fact, $2 billion a year. Congressman Cleaver, can any case be made for making cuts to support for food stamps? Is there overspending? Is too much money being spent on food stamps, or would you like to see funding maintained at its current levels?
I think We ought to be ashamed of ourselves that we're even having this discussion. And one of the reasons we're having this discussion is all of the myths that have been intentionally perpetuated by those who would like to maintain some kind of political ditch between Republicans and Democrats, people who can benefit with people feeling like that. And the reason I'm saying that is, I've heard all that, people buy cars with the food stamps and prisoners are getting food stamps and they're buying lottery tickets and so forth. The truth of the matter is 22 million recipients of food stamps are children and 9 million are elderly or disabled. I'd like to believe that I'm a citizen in a country that takes care of those who are hurting. And so I don't know. I mean, how do you say we are wasting money by feeding children or feeding our elderly? Many of them are veterans.
And about 91%, I might be off just a little, of the SNAP benefits go to households with incomes below the poverty line. And the poverty line is gross income. And of the 23,500 a year for a family of four, you're hardly ripping off the American taxpayers when you're trying to help people in that kind of a situation. And then on the other hand, we're still giving money to people who have farms almost as the size of General Electric.
Professor Smith, what would you like to see change in this bill to make it better? I assume you think there is a farm bill that could and should pass. What should it have?
Well, the truth is that we'd be better off with current law than with the House bill or the Senate bill. And from a fairness approach, we would be much better off with a bill that simply ended the direct payments program, which is just welfare checks to people who don't qualify under anyone's criteria for need that they receive every year, because 30 years ago, either corn, wheat, rice, or some other eligible crop was grown on the land they now own. That's obviously a nonsense program. That's $5 billion that could go back in to deficit reduction or to fund health care for the poor and so on. This is just a bad bill. There are a whole plethora of new programs to give more and more money to mainly the wealthy farmers. It's very difficult to justify any of what's in the House bill. One irony, by the way, is that no one's paid attention to a research and development funding for agriculture, and we know public funding there has been extremely beneficial in improving U.S. agriculture, making it very efficient, and that issue has been ignored. We know we're underfunding by about $1 to $2 billion a year, public R&D spending. And to come back to Congressman Cleaver's concerns, I am very much in agreement with him that much of the food stamp program monies are going to people who genuinely need those funds. We know that because of the food stamp program, children who are in very poor families have somewhat better nutrition. We also know that there's very little evidence that this program generates an increase in obesity, which is one of the criticisms that has been leveled at. But the evidence is frankly not there that there are any real effects on that issue. There is a set of issues about wanting to make sure that fraud is minimized, and recent shifts in how the programs have been administered have vastly reduced fraud in most places. There are high points of problems with fraud in certain areas of, say, Detroit, where the gangs have gotten into sort of systematic fraud. But in general, fraud in the food stamp program is very modest now. There are some poster childs for reform, and we shouldn't be giving every student at the University of Michigan food stamps. Why would my kid get food stamps just because she's enrolled in a Big Ten college? That's a problem. But Congressman Cleaver's right. I mean, the food stamps are a really important part of the safety net for the very poorest people in the country. And while there could be reforms that make it more efficient, draconian cuts are not a good idea.
I want to invite our listeners, if you have thoughts about the Farm Bill's SNAP program, what do you think of these proposed changes? If you're from Iowa or Kansas or Missouri, give us a call. The number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. That was Vincent Smith of Montana State University, also talking with Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. Congressman Cleaver, what of this conversation about fraud and waste in the SNAP program? We hear that a lot in this debate. Do you think there is a problem, and do you think that cutting these funds will help address that?
No. And this is unfortunate, and most Americans are completely unaware of this, and so they allow themselves to be used. Particularly people in rural areas, they believe that the people in the city are ripping them off, and people in the suburbs believe the same thing. But and generalities. The food stamp program has already reduced a great deal of the fraud that existed. And frankly, it's important to say fraud exists in every single program, whether it's, you name it, and people will find a way to do wrong. But when we began the electronic benefit transfer cards, these are like credit cards. It's important for people to understand there are no stamps that were probably 1996.
Right, EBT.
We have these EBT cards, and these cards allowed us to reduce the fraud and waste. And the truth of the matter is, I sat in a room and listened to somebody say that people in prison were getting food stamps. I mean, and the other people in the room were shaking their heads in approval. Yeah, we know. I just think that's tragic.
And for the record, that's not true, yep. Right? Nobody in prison receives food stamps.
No, the card would not allow you to do that. And I'd like to find the warden who has scheduled bus rides by prisoners to Safeway so they can use their food stamps. I mean, if people think about that stuff, they'd say, oh, boy, that is ridiculous.
Let's take a really quick call from Vince in Paola, Kansas. Vince, can you ask your question as quickly as possible?
Sure. The thought is, why don't we give food stamps to every citizen? And thereby cutting back on the administration fees and the arguing we're going through now. Of course, that would mean a slight rise in taxes and a reduction in other program monies that go out there. We could do the same thing with housing.
So,
and thank you for considering that.
Any response to that from our guests? Any chance of equalizing benefits that way?
I do have a response, but go ahead.
Go ahead, Congressman Cleaver.
I think one of the other fallacies, one of the other bad pieces of information, is that we waste a lot of money on administration, and if you look at the new numbers as it relates to administration, it's unbelievably leaning toward eliminating or reducing
Congressman
the administrative
Cleaver,
costs.
I appreciate that. I have to.
Of every dollar
I have to cut you off.
We're families for food.
I appreciate it, Congressman Cleaver, Vincent Smith of Montana State. We'll be back after this to talk more about SNAP. You're listening to Central Standard on Iowa Public Radio and KCUR. From KCUR in Kansas City, this is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, the first of a two-part special program on the Farm Bill in a joint broadcast with Iowa Public Radio. We've been talking a lot today about the policy and political implications of what's happening this month in Washington, especially around the proposed cuts to the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, as they're more commonly known. But on the streets of Des Moines and Kansas City and in the rural communities of Kansas and Iowa and Missouri, all those debates take a backseat to the hard reality of just not being able to feed your family. Joining us to talk about hunger and how SNAP makes a difference or doesn't is Tamara Grubb. She's Chief Operating Officer for Second Harvest Community Food Bank in St. Joseph, Missouri. Welcome to you, Tamara.
Good morning.
They distribute food to a region covering 19 counties in northwest Missouri and northeast Kansas. And also one person who benefited from Second Harvest's work and also from the SNAP program, Regina Oberman. She lives in St. Joe, and she's also joining us today. Welcome to you, Regina.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad you're here. Regina, when did you first become aware of the food stamp program?
I became aware back when my children were much younger, and I was a single mom, and we needed to have some assistance to get food and groceries to feed those children. And I've always been a working person, but we sometimes would fall in that gap. You know, I broke my leg, lost my job, was on, couldn't get disability, couldn't get unemployment because I wasn't employable. So we were down to $350 a month to try to pay rent, feed us, utilities, car payments, all those things. So I had to reach out to different assistance programs, and one of those happened to be the food stamp or SNAP program.
Well, that was 25 years ago. Did you got out of that situation? Did you ever think you'd be on benefits, federal benefits like this again?
No, I really didn't. I thought, okay, I've healed. I'm back to work. I have a job. You know, we're good to go. And then in 2010, you know, that nosedive of the economy, I ended up losing my job in December. And then the following February, my husband lost his job. And so here we are again. You know, I'm getting unemployment. He hadn't worked long enough to qualify. So on less than $300 a week of unemployment was what we had to live on. Here again, you know, house payments, car payments, utilities, all those things. And so I already was aware of the food stamp program or SNAP and how to go about that. So we went and applied. I went and applied again. And we received a whole $160 a month in SNAP benefits.
Okay, so how much money did you have coming into the house before applying for the SNAP benefits?
Before?
If I can ask that.
Yeah. I was making $11 an hour. He was making $10 an hour.
Okay.
So
both of you working.
Both of us working, about $21 an hour. And then I lost my job and I got unemployment. But like I said, he did not. So we were making from that $21 an hour figure down to, I figured it up, $5.65 an hour was what my unemployment benefit was.
So you said $160 a month was your SNAP benefit. And the way you said that brings out the reality that doesn't go very far.
No, no.
What did you do with that $160?
The best I could. I would go to the store. I would make a list. I would check the ads. I would see what was on sale, what was the best bang for my buck, I guess you could say. If there was something that at one point in time during a Lenten season, they had a 10-pound box of fish on sale for like $1.90 a pound. So I knew that would supply us with groceries or food, you know, for an extended period of time.
Not a lot of money, but was it enough? Were you able to survive on it?
No. If it hadn't been for the food pantries, Second Harvest in particular, and then the places that they provide food for, like your church local food pantries or maybe the food kitchens and things like that, they help to supplement what the SNAP didn't take care of.
I want to invite our listeners to share, as they are willing, their own experiences with the SNAP program or other forms of support when you have been in times of hunger or financial difficulty. Have you or people close to you been on food stamps? And what are the practical implications of SNAP for your community? Give us a call, Kansas, Missouri, or Iowa. We want to hear from you, 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tamara Grubb, how typical is Regina's story that she shared here?
It's very typical. You know, on a weekly basis, Second Harvest Community Food Bank serves about 15,000 individuals a week. So if you can imagine, that's 15,000 stories that are very similar to Regina's. In our service territory of Northwest Missouri and Northeast Kansas, there's 51,000 individuals that are food insecure. Those are folks that don't quite know where their next meal is going to come from. So again, you take, you know, Regina's story and there's another, you know, 51,000 of those stories that exist.
I want to listen to a couple of those stories from some of our listeners. Let's talk to Aaron in Northeast Missouri. Aaron, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, good morning, guys. First of all, I want to say that my family has used in Northeast Missouri the WIC program for the infant, women, and children, where they give you vouchers for milk, cheese, etc., eggs, basics.
Yeah.
And that seemed to work very well. And Regina, the lady you were talking to, she sounds very responsible, but in my line of work, I go to a lot of different convenience stores. I see that people using these cards, getting Mountain Dew or, you know, the sodas, the junk food, the stuff that's not the best choice, not the best use of money. What do you guys think about going to a voucher system with the SNAP or the EBT type stuff?
And by a voucher system, you mean that only buys certain kinds of food with certain kinds of coupons?
Correct. I mean, it'd be more regulated, but your money would be for sure going to the right stuff. And I think everybody would be happy. They'd be getting the food they need, the nutrition. Nobody'd be going hungry. And I'll say the taxpayers would be, I don't know, I would be happier, you know, buying someone some eggs versus, you know, three Mountain Dews from a convenience store for $5.
Thanks for the question, Aaron. Appreciate that. I'm sure a lot of people are thinking that. Tamara, what can people buy with EBT funds, and do you worry about people spending it on the wrong things?
Yeah, you know, with the EBT funds, the food, the benefits that folks get, it's strictly for food. And whether we like it or not, Pepsi and Mountain Dew are considered food. One of the things that's important to recognize is access is not equal in our country. There are many folks that are on the food stamp program that their closest place to access groceries is at a convenience store. So if you can imagine, you know, most of us can go get in our cars and we can drive to whatever grocery store we want to go to. You know, folks that live in food deserts that have a lack of access, a lack of transportation, their closest place is a local convenience store. And convenience stores, you know, they typically have milk and bread and things like that. But everything else that is within those stores is typically not healthy foods. And so, again, you know, until we can fix the fact that access is unequal, the current program works.
Let's talk to Lori. She's calling us from Ames, Iowa. Lori, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I'm calling. I have a daughter who has Down syndrome, and she's a 30-year-old young woman who lives on SSI income and a job that she has, basically about $800 a month. And she has benefited greatly from the food assistance program using the EBT card in the most recent years. But beginning in about 2010, her benefits began getting cut back with budget cuts, and her last month of benefits, she was eligible for $2.49 of food assistance. And
$2.49 for the month?
Yes. And, you know, she has the EBT card that's like a debit card with a PIN number. And when you go to the grocery store, you scan all your groceries and then you swipe the EBT card. And it will tell you the amount that you can use with from your EBT funds and the amount that are not allowed, the purchases that are not allowed. And, you know, I'm always just puzzled when I hear people talking about all of the fraud in food stamps, because I have found to keep her receiving the benefits has been this incredibly rigorous and, you know, filled with oversight that, you know, you have to report if your income changes by a very small amount, either more or less. You get calls from the people, you know, who are in the State Department overseeing this, you know, right, inquiring about who's living in the household. And, you know, so to me, when I hear that people are selling their food stamps and that there are people in prison and all of this, I'm just appalled and realize people don't have a clue about how this works.
Okay. Lori, thank you so much for the call. We really appreciate it.
You know,
Tamara, you help a lot of folks in Lori's situation. What is the reality? She mentioned having a daughter with disability who receives food stamps. How desperate do folks have to be before they get on food stamps? And then what happens when they get down to $2.49 a month in benefits?
You know, that's the thing is we see many folks, if we look at our seniors, the senior population, typically ones that are living on their fixed income with Social Security, things like that, their average benefit is about $16 a month is what they actually receive.
Wow.
So although it is assistance and it does help, you know, it's just simply not enough. And that's where, you know, food banks throughout the country and local food pantries have to come in to assist, very similar to what we did with Regina. You know, she was receiving a benefit. The benefit is not enough. It doesn't last throughout a month. And we have to support essentially the lack of the federal safety net.
Regina, to what extent did you have to turn to food banks and other sources beyond the SNAP benefits?
Well, our local food bank, Second Harvest, it has an on-site pantry that you can go once a week and get fresh produce and milk and dairy, more perishable things. So I would generally be there once a week to help supplement what I got in food stamps. And then also once a month, you can go to the local church pantry and get more of the what people used to consider government commodities. Some of the older people out there probably remember that term, you know, like the peanut butter and maybe the cheese and some type of protein or beans or whatever, to help also stretch that $160 benefit to last an entire month.
You know, Tamara, when we hear these sorts of things, from $160, which isn't very much, to $2.49, which isn't anything at all, yours is not the only organization that supports folks in these situations. In fact, there's a whole network. Harvesters is one familiar here in Kansas City, the Food Bank of Iowa for our listeners in Iowa today. Could we do away with SNAP and rely on sources like yours? It doesn't seem like it's that much money in the first place.
No, absolutely not. You know, the Food Bank Network, as it sits right now, is, you know, we're making it work. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, in Second Harvest's service territory, there's 51,000 individuals that need our help. We're currently helping 15,000. So although that's great, there's 36,000 people in our service territory, just Northwest Missouri, Northeast Kansas, that we're not able to assist. So that's where, you know, when we talk about the Farm Bill, you know, and if there are cuts to SNAP, the food bank system and the local charitable system has to pick up that slack. And that cannot happen. There are not enough resources to be able to meet that need. That's where, you know, SNAP works to be able to, it has to be, we have to have solid federal programs along with good charitable organizations.
We have a full board of calls, a lot of interest in this topic. Let's talk to Dave in Overland Park. Dave, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. I know you're short on time, so I'll make this as fast as I can.
Please do. Thanks.
I only just got on SNAP yesterday. I have a family of three with a pregnant daughter, and we're living on $710 SSI a month.
And
without SNAP, I'd be living under a freaking overpass next month.
And how much money are you getting from SNAP as a new enrollee?
I'm getting $186 a month, but that's cash assistance that is actually reducing my food stamps by an equal amount.
I see. So Dave, is this a sustainable situation for you? Will you be able to make it with that amount of assistance?
Define sustainable. I've been doing this now for almost 7 years without the SNAP.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thanks for sharing your story. I think it's good for folks to hear from folks who are really in the situation. Appreciate your calling.
Thank you.
Let's talk to Shai in Des Moines, Iowa. Shai, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I wanted to kind of talk about kind of how I've experienced it. I grew up in a poverty-stricken home and lifestyle with a mother who was mentally ill, and we relied on food stamps and food banks in order to meet our needs every month. As I grew up and became a professional, I worked in kind of the disability field, mental health field, where I assisted people in getting benefits. So I have a really thorough knowledge kind of the need that is out there. But now as a professional, I wonder why we're still even grouping the SNAP benefit with the Farm Bill when it's actually a needs-based program. It seems to me that it would make more sense for it to become a Medicaid type of program, a benefit, versus something that's completely associated with something that doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah, it's a good question, Shai. We talked a little bit about that earlier with our political figures and our policy analysts. There was something of a marriage of convenience in putting it in the Farm Bill. It joined urban and rural interested parties together. It's also a benefit to farmers to have this money going back into the system. Tamara, I know that you've talked a little bit about the economic development or the good for business aspects of the Farm Bill.
Yeah, whenever there are individuals who are eligible for the program and when they're able to get enrolled in the program, those are dollars that they're able to spend at local grocers. And if we look at the food chain, you know, for every $1 that's given in a food stamp benefit, $1.89 is generated in economic activity. So if you look at all the way back to the farmer who grew the food, all the way to the retailer that it hit their shelves, when there's dollars available for families to be able to access food, that is an economic benefit.
Very quickly, Regina, what's next for you?
Try to maintain my job and help with the food banks and the things and to bring awareness to this problem as much as I possibly can.
That's Regina Oberman. She is a recipient of SNAP benefits. She lives in St. Joseph, Missouri. Tamara Grubb is Chief Operating Officer of Second Harvest Community Food Bank. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen to this conversation again or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page at kcur.org. We hope you'll join us tomorrow as we continue the conversation about the Farm Bill in the second of our two special broadcasts from Iowa Public Radio and KCUR Kansas City Public Media. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, Charity Nebbe will talk about the farmier parts of the Farm Bill, crop insurance and farm subsidies, and the critical role they play in today's agricultural economy. Special thanks to Harvest Public Media, which is a collaboration with KCUR, Iowa Public Radio, and other public media stations across the Midwest. You can find more information about the Farm Bill at harvestpublicmedia.org. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. We had help from Iowa Public Radio and from KCUR's Claire McInerney, Ross Steinmetz, and Sangeeta Shastri. From KCUR in Kansas City, I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great day.